The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live Internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Welcome to What About Wealth? Making it, investing it, protecting it, leaving a legacy with your hosts, Rich Bloomfield and Rick Durfee. In today's economy, preserving wealth has become more important than ever, especially when it comes to our future generations. Now, here is Rich Bloomfield and Rick Durfee.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to What About Wealth?
What about wealth? Good morning, good morning. We have an exciting topic today. It's a good one, it's a good one.
So this is something that you and I do a lot of. We realize that we work a lot with medical professionals of all kinds, and so we're going to do a show especially for them today.
Medical professionals have unique needs and concerns in their plannings, planning that others don't have. And by the end of the show, we are going to identify the number one risk to wealth accumulation for medical professionals and how to avoid it. The answer is going to surprise you, but it is the number one thing that causes medical professionals to lose everything they've got and have to start over. So we're going to hit that before the end of the show.
Yes, and I know what that is, and I know that you've dealt with it a lot, Rick, so with your clients. So yeah, I think it will be surprising to most people, but it'll be a good thing to know. So listen and learn.
The other thing before we're done is part of today's program, a special offer to our listeners. If they contact us, we have a very, it's really a cool diagram that details all of the various structures that we're going to be talking about today, specifically for medical professionals and what they are and how they work. And so for this program, our special offer is if you contact us, we will give you one of those custom, ultimate plan designs for medical professionals for free. And we'll send that to any one of our listeners that contact us.
Great. And I know that there are a lot of advisors that listen to our program, Rick, professional financial advisors, and I know a lot of them have medical professionals as clients, so even for those guys, if they'd like to get a little bit more up on how this all works, call us, we'll get you a diagram, and that will help you a lot as you discuss this with your clients. To get us started here, Rick, I just wanted to make sure everyone knows who we're talking about here, because this covers quite a broad area. We talk about medical professionals because we have doctors and dentists that everybody thinks about, but there's also physician's assistants. I have a daughter that's in school at Northwestern right now, studying to be a PA, and a son-in-law at another program in Idaho. There are chiropractors, physical therapists, nurses. I have another daughter who's a nurse, but she's gone to school and gotten her master's, so she's now a nurse practitioner. So those would be included, and midwives. And there are probably other ones that we've forgotten, Rick, but those are the main ones that we work with in our practice.
Well, it's these days, in fact, this industry is changing. The paraprofessional, as you point out, the nurse practitioner often has as heavy of a burden, as much responsibility and as much liability as a surgeon or a physician might. So it's critical that all medical professionals, I think this would apply to whatever label they put on, whether we've mentioned them or not. So they have, as medical professionals, some unique and special concerns, some things that may not apply to others. Some of the obvious being, often they are the high income earners in our society. They're able to earn a lot, and as such, they have big tax issues. They have, of course, the professional liability issues, which are huge, which can be a giant risk factor to deal with. They are often a target because of the risk then for lawsuits. They're also a target for scams. It's almost legendary that surgeons, physicians, for example, make a lot of money, and you can get them to invest in your stupid idea, and they'll put money in it because the money doesn't mean anything to them. So the hucksters and scammers out there are targeting medical professionals. They also tend to, because they have big income, over time, they tend to accumulate a lot. They end up with a lot of assets, a lot of businesses. They often are very entrepreneurial, and there's a significant difference in medical practitioners between the business owner, business builder mentality versus the employee mentality. And actually, in today's market, we're seeing a change in that, largely because of the next factor, which is the big student debt. It used to be 10 years ago, as we dealt with new medical professionals coming into the market, that they would be buying practices or starting practices, and they would have the borrowing capacity to do so. We've seen that reduced in the last decade because they're coming into their beginning years of practice burdened with monstrous debt coming out of school. And then obviously over time, even with the burden of student debt in the beginning, over time they build big estates. We deal with medical professionals after 20 or 30 or 40 years of practice that will have a significant amount of money. And they've got a plan for that, and planning early makes a big difference. And then, of course, when you hear the politicians talk about taxing rich people and making them pay their fair share, these high-income earners are right in the dead center of the target for those tax planning issues. So, and then I guess the final one, often as much as estate planning or tax planning, medical professionals are as much or more concerned about the asset protection side of things. So the risk of lawsuits is present and immediate right now, whereas estate taxes and other things don't happen until you die. So how to plan for all that.
Right, and obviously, if they plan well for the asset protection, then they don't end up, it isn't quite so difficult to have an estate tax problem later on, because if you don't plan well on the asset protection side, you could end up getting wiped out once or twice during your career, and that's never a fun thing. So we do a lot of work, and Rick, I know you especially do a lot of work on this, on the asset protection, but because these people are targets for a lot of things, and if you're a target for a lawsuit and you plan for it, I know the planning that we do, Rick, it's very difficult for people to get your stuff, and we structure it so that it's extremely difficult for anyone to come in and take your things. Obviously, there are things we always tell people this. You know, if you mess up, and you don't have insurance to cover it, then there are some things we can't protect you against. But we can protect you against the scam artists and people that are just looking for a deep pocket. So So that's an important part of the planning. And let me say right here at the front of the show that when we do planning for someone, and we're not myopic about it. We look at the whole picture, and we're worried about all of these things. And there are certain structures that you can do that take care of them in a very effective way. So asset protection, estate planning, income tax structures, all of those can be done in one very good, solid plan, Rick. And we really enjoy doing that kind of thing, because then it sets people up for their entire life practice, and they don't end up having these missteps along the way. And
you know, yeah, exactly. What struck me with what you're saying is the kind of the life cycle of a professional practice. We work with people that in every phase, in the beginning, in kind of the middle, at the end, at the retirement phase. And one of the significant a couple of phases in the early years, I call it the I'm immortal phase, the illusion of immortality, that I'm invincible. I'm never going to die, and I'm never going to get sued. And then we have a kind of a coming of age event. And it's usually, hopefully, it's not when you get sued. It's when your partner or your friend or your colleague or your buddy, your golf buddy or your the guy, the professional that shares the locker with you next to you gets sued. When they get sued, that's the get religion. I suddenly, whoa, my friend got sued. They got taken to the cleaners. They lost everything. And then suddenly all their colleagues are rushing to put in appropriate protection to protect themselves.
Right. Now, Rick, the first thing along those lines that we need to talk about is the choice of entity problem. There are just a lot of ways that a business can be put together. You use corporations, partnerships, LLCs, sole proprietorships. Then there's the PC, PLC, PLLC, S corporations, C corporations. There's all these things that you know, when you're out there, that you hear people talk about, and for a lot of people, their head just spins. You know, it's like, my goodness, you just talked about 10 things there. How do we know how to do this? How do you know which is best, and what's really best for the for my particular kind of business? And today we're talking about the medical practice. So enlighten us a little bit on that, Rick. What do we do?
Well, without doing the 4-hour choice of entity seminar, I'm just going to cut right to the bottom line. I'm just going to say it flat out. The best form of entity for a professional practice is going to be an LLC or a PLLC or PLC. But bottom line, it's an LLC that elects to be taxed as a corporation. And in most instances, that election will be to be taxed as an S-corp. So the majority that we see that after we do all the calculating and analysis and figuring out, well, what's best for you, it's going to be an LLC taxed as an S-corp.
Okay. And so the reason that we've come to that conclusion, there are several things. So tell us about why you prefer that. I mean, you're an attorney, so it seems like you'd be wanting the one that with the most work, but I know we've gotten past that a long time ago, and we're just looking for what works best. So
yes.
Tell us about that.
So why an LLC? Why not just a corporation? Because corporations 20 years ago were the thing that every professional would come out and would set up a professional corporation or something. And with corporations, a couple of issues. Stock in a corporation is personal property. It can be taken away from you by your creditors. Corporations are required by law to have annual meetings and prepare minutes of those meetings. And corporations typically have to do annual filings and annual reports with their local corporation commission, or in some states, the Secretary of State. And LLCs eliminate all of those things. They have no annual filings, no annual reports. There's no statutory requirement that they hold annual meetings or have minutes of their meetings. And super critical, the ownership that you have in an LLC is not stock. It's not personal property. It's a membership. And that membership cannot be levied. It cannot be garnished. It cannot be taken away from you so the bad guys can't come and get it. And then super critical, this is a biggie with LLCs, is an LLC can elect how it's going to be taxed. So an LLC can be taxed as a partnership. It can be taxed as a C corporation. It can be taxed as an S corporation. So we can get whatever tax treatment we want, but we can do that under the structure of the LLC. So we avoid all those annual maintenance issues and all those chinks in the armor, so to speak. Failure to do any of those things, failure to have your annual minutes, failure to file your annual report, or a personal judgment against you places your corporation and all of its contents at risk. So yeah, gets around it.
I can't even tell you, Rick, and you've probably had as many or many more or more than I have, but I can't even tell you the number of clients that have come in and we look at their existing entities and they've been dissolved, administratively dissolved by the state because they didn't do one of these things. They forgot the annual filing or they forgot to pay the fee. Let me point out, just so people don't think we're completely off base or out of touch here, there are some states in which an annual filing is required by the LLC, but that is typically it's mostly just because they want to charge you a fee. And so it's very simple. You get online and you say, okay, I'm renewing, and you pay a small fee. So some states have gone to that model. And so they made it a little more complicated, but it's not at all like filing for a corporation where you have to provide a bunch of information, fill out a form, make sure it's signed, and you got to get the officers to sign, et cetera.
Yeah. So it's more of a tax than a report.
Exactly. Right. So you like an LLC taxed as an S-Corp. So tell us more about that. Tell us why you prefer that structure.
We will talk about why, but I think first we got to take a break. And we want to remind you that after the break, we'll talk about the why taxed as an S-Corp and remind you that before the end of the show, we're going to tell you the number one risk event that causes medical professionals to lose everything they've spent their lifetime accumulating. We'll talk about that S-Corporation issue after the break.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network. What does a visual workplace mean to you? How does it contribute to operational excellence? And what steps do you take to put it powerfully in place? Listen to The Visual Workplace, Work That Makes Sense, to find out. Each week, Dr. Gwendolyn Galsworth, visual workplace expert and award-winning author, shares tools and strategies to help you make the workplace speak at a glance without saying a word. Learn to work safer, faster, better, and at far less cost, no matter what business you're in. Tune in to The Visual Workplace every Tuesday at 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern on Voice America Business.
What would you do if you knew that you could not fail? The Dr. Pat Show with Dr. Pat Basile is a radio forum for some of the world's most influential people in the fields of health, wellness, and human potential. Dr. Pat brings together and introduces visionary scientists and futurists, environmentalists, educators, business leaders, inventors, filmmakers, authors, artists, mystics, and healers who inspire and support individual and collective growth and positive cultural shifts. This award-winning radio show empowers the listening community to be the change they want to see in the world. Tune in every Thursday at 8 a.m. Pacific for the Dr. Pat Show with Dr. Pat Basile, radio to thrive by.
Is marketing making us ill? And if it is, how can we heal humanity and the planet by changing the way we sell? This is Lynn Serafin inviting you to join me and a great lineup of thought leaders in business, media, and marketing on The Seven Graces of Marketing, Mondays at 6 a.m. U.S. Pacific Time on the Voice America Business Channel. So let the dialogue begin.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
You are tuned in to What About Wealth with Rich Bloomfield and Rick Durfee. If you have a question or comment about our program, please send an email to info@whataboutwealth.com. That's info@whataboutwealth.com. Now back to Rick and Rich.
All right, Rick, we're back. So before the break, we were talking about this S-Corp, LLC taxes and S-Corp, and you're going to give us a few more insights on why that works so well.
Bottom line, the S-Corp is an efficient tax planning device for the high-income earner. Ordinarily, if you have a C-Corp or a partnership, either one, 100% of the income pouring out of that entity is going to be W-2 or earned income, subject to self-employment, and you pay the most taxes you possibly can. By having the S-Corp, a fraction of that income is able to be treated as K-1 income, not earned income, but dividend type of income. And that helps, frankly, if you're married, because your spouse obviously, presumably is not working in the practice, is not the professional. So the income attributed to the spouse can be K-1 income, not earned. So you don't pay those self-employment taxes on that. Now, sometimes it's better to have a C corporation, especially if there's lots of big expenses like medical expenses or for certain types of planning, retirement planning that we're going to hopefully get to before the end of the program. And often it's important to point out that this LLC or this PLLC, whatever it is we're doing here for our professional practice, is just one of many entities. So it also depends on what else you got going on. May affect whether it should be taxed as an S-Corp or as a C-Corp.
Right, and Rick, you know, what really ends up happening in most of these situations, if it doesn't happen immediately, it happens somewhere along the way, is that we end up with multiple entities. So the practice is run through an LLC taxed as an S-Corp, but then we have other entities in the structure where you might have another LLC which elects to be taxed as a C-Corp. Maybe that's a management company that manages your practice and other businesses that you have, and we can do some really cool things in the C-Corp. So you're not really just stuck with one, and most often you're not, because it just doesn't make sense and you really need some of these other structures. So those are the kind of things that that we can discuss more with each individual situation. And, you know, our diagram that we're offering for people will help kind of throw some light on that, too.
You know, I want to point out that it's important here to avoid the cowboy planning. That's what I call it. That's when either the lawyer or the CPA on their own runs out and says, oh, just do this without consulting the other one. In fact, Rich, you and I recently had a case with an accountant who does this kind of cowboy planning and then ends up, we have to go clean it up and fix it after the fact. It's really critical that in making the decision, well, what should my professional practice, how should it be structured, that you consult your advisory team as a team, get input from both the lawyer and the CPA, whoever's doing your tax work. Because they will have different perspectives, they will be have different concerns, and you've got to factor all of those issues in to get the best plan. Now,
I want to point out here, Rick, because a lot of our listeners out there really should know this, is that we are kind of unique, and you know, after many many years of working together, we have a plan where it's I call it a turnkey structure, so that you don't have to worry about going back and forth between the CPA and the attorney. We've already done that. You and I work together closely. We've come up with a turnkey sort of situation for professionals, so that when they come in and say, what do we do? It doesn't matter whether they're talking to you or talking to me. We've already had these discussions over the years. We've already worked all this out. We've been down the road with audits and legal issues and problems, and we've worked out what is the best plan from all these perspectives. And so people have to do that, and most people like that, because it gets very confusing when you're going back and forth between professionals that may not be seeing eye to eye.
Yeah, well, that's right. Having worked out the issues, the In fact, the issue that I was referring to is someone that both of us have done business with in the past who knows how we feel and almost in a contrarian fashion, just to prove he can, goes out and does this thing that we all disapprove of, knowing that we're going to have to clean it up later. It's kind of frustrating. But another question that comes up is, well, do I have to be a PC or a PLLC or a PLC? What's the P? The P stands for professional, and it's important to point out that this entity, when you choose an entity or a structure to put your professional practice in, because you are a professional, this entity will not shield you from professional liability. If you commit professional malpractice, you're still going to be held accountable to the standards of your profession, and there's frankly other structures that are necessary to protect you from that sort of liability, but this structure doesn't do it. And the need, whether we have to put the P in the name or not, is specific to each state. Some states permit medical practices to just be a flat out an LLC. It's also specific to each practice. Different types of medical practice may or may not have to have that, the P, the professional designation, as part of their structure.
Okay, and so that's something that, depending on which state you live in, and we can figure that out quickly, but it's, some people just like to have it in there, and because it sounds better, and that's okay too. So, Rick, the next important issue is, how should this LLC that's taxed as an S corp, how should we own that? Who should own it, and what structure should own it? How do we set that up so that it's the best for a medical professional?
Yeah, a huge mistake we see is that people will come in and it will be owned individually, it'll be owned personally, and frankly, nothing should ever be owned personally, even your medical practice. And they'll say, well, but professionally, I'm obligated to own it. Well, that's true, yes, but still, the vehicle to own that is still going to be a trust. And the cornerstone of any good estate planning in the United States is the revocable trust and what we call the basic documents, your living wills and medical powers of attorney and durable general powers of attorney and your wills. And we're not going to spend a lot of time on that, but that's got to be the foundation. And I want to kind of point out here a professional with their high income earning, high asset accumulation, and the high likelihood that they're going to leave wealth to future generations really ought to look at upgrading a typical revocable trust to the dynasty planning with the revocable dynasty trust, which is kind of an upgrade from the entry level kind of planning.
So just basically, because I know people have this question all the time, Rick, is what is the difference? See, most people out there, they're worrying about being a doctor or a dentist or whatever. What's the difference between the entry level and the dynasty trust, the high level? What are the differences?
Yeah, the simplest and shortest explanation is the typical estate planning revocable trust focuses on what happens up to and at the point of death. We're going to plan until you die, we're going to avoid probate, and then we're going to hand off assets and avoid probate. But the dynasty plan, the dynasty trust, looks at, okay, what's going to happen after I'm dead? How's the money going to flow? Is it going to be protected? Is it going to be left unprotected? Is it going to be structured so that it's beneficial, it blesses them instead of messes them up? So the classic revocable trust plans up to the point of death. A dynasty trust adds, in addition to up to the point of death, plans after that. What's going to happen after that?
Okay, thanks. And what I want to point out here too is that because many of our clients and advisors that we work with know that typically because of the size of estates that are accumulated with medical professionals, we don't usually stop with the revocable trust. Then we have what's called an irrevocable or an irrevocable dynasty trust. So just so no one is confused out there, this, if you're just looking at the revocable trust, that means that you're probably just starting out, you have very few assets, and you're at an early point in your career, But, you know, many professionals, because they know they're going to accumulate wealth over time, they come in and we do a complete plan, which includes the irrevocable trust. And that's a whole different discussion than we can have today, but it's an important thing to know. And that this revocable trust isn't going to do a whole lot of estate planning, what we call classic estate planning, for you, because it doesn't really have a significant ability to move assets out of your estate, especially during your life.
Well, and you're right. And although we're mentioning some of these things in our 1 hour program here today, we can't go into a lot of detail. We just don't have time. We have to kind of put the big rocks in the jar, so to speak. And one of the big rocks I want to get to and spend some time on here is that becomes a huge planning issue are the retirement plans. And often medical professionals get, this is a place where the scam artists just stream through the door. And that's probably harsh. They're not all scam artists, but people selling you stuff that may or may not be in your best interest come streaming through the door. So we need to have some discussion here. How do we pick the best type of retirement plan for medical professionals?
Okay. So first of all, you mentioned this earlier in the show, but a lot of medical professionals now are coming out of school with an enormous amount of debt. I can testify to that because I have a couple of children that have done that. And so they end up being employees, or at least at the beginning, because they really can't afford with their debt load to buy a practice, and or a bank won't lend them enough to do it, et cetera. So sometimes you end up being an employee. And so in that situation, obviously, you need to take advantage of whatever retirement plan contributions your employer offers, and build up an IRA or a 401k, whatever is being offered, hopefully in the Roth format. And let me point out that more and more plans now are allowing people to elect to accumulate as a Roth. And so the Roth, of course, just quickly allows, you don't get a deduction for that today, but down the road, as you take it out, you don't have to pay any tax on it. And so it's not just a tax deferral, it's tax-free kind of income as you go along. So, people say, well, you know, we have this income limit, so how do we set up as a Roth? Or how do we get our funds into a Roth format? And there are backdoor ways to do that, because today anybody can convert a traditional to a Roth. It's just that if you have income limits, you can't just go directly into a Roth. So that's kind of a discussion, you know, for another full program. And we actually have a program if people want to go look at it, where we've discussed that in more detail. But important to know, because you can contribute to a non-deductible traditional IRA and then convert it. And then there are some rules in there that you have to be careful of if you have other IRAs, because some of it might be taxable if you're not careful. So Rick, we end up seeing medical professionals at the end of their career trying to figure out what to do with, sometimes they come in with this bloated retirement plan. And, that's typically a traditional sort of plan. And on rare occasions that we've seen that they actually have a withdrawal plan to use that up. But in most cases that we see, they've accumulated enough other income producing assets, as like the buildings and the sale of the practice or whatever. They don't actually need the retirement plans. So they're looking for a tax efficient way to get those funds out. And so the most tax efficient way to get money out of a retirement plan, as you and I have discussed many times, is you just don't put it there in the first place. So talk to us about that and why we think that.
Well, I want to point out that the word is out. It has become people have figured out that the traditional retirement plan of putting in tax deductible money today, which we get the tax deduction, yippee-ki-yay, and then getting that tax deferred growth, HUA, is actually a trap, that it nails you when you get down to the exit and we're trying to get the money out. And it nails you because, well, it gets taxed and people don't like paying the taxes. And so they tend to hang on to the dumb thing until they die. And then without, you know, thinking, oh, I'm being clever and not paying the tax. But when they die, then they, in addition to the income tax, end up paying an estate tax. So we get double whacked on the tax. So here's the deal and the bottom line. All of these retirement plans that we've talked about so far are government retirement plans. They're designed by the politicians. And they have a goal, and the goal may not be the same goal that you have. And it's important to remember that whoever makes the rules can change the rules. And if it's a politically designed and motivated plan organized by the government, then the government can change the deal. And it's their deal, so they can change it. So in reality, the Roth IRA is a government competition for a very old private contractual plan that doesn't have the additional burden of having been designed by politicians and therefore subject to change of the politicians. So I'm just going to tell you straight up, what? There's a private retirement plan that I don't have to get government sanction on to do, that I don't have to worry about the politicians messing with the rules? Well, yeah, there is. And it's a plan that, in fact, the Roth IRA was designed by politicians to compete with. Because word was out that, hey, there's this private alternative that's way better than a traditional IRA, and the politicians didn't want to let that go unchallenged, so they came up with competition. Well, what is it? What is the plan? I'm just going to tell you straight up. It's low death benefit, high cash value life insurance. And I don't sell life insurance. I'm the lawyer. But I believe in this enough that I will tell you straight up, me personally, as a professional, I have no government-sponsored retirement plans. No IRAs, no Roths, no 401ks, none of those. But I do have overfunded, high cash value, low death benefit life insurance. And it's simple. You put after-tax dollars in your life insurance policy, and you want a low death benefit because it makes it more efficient. The internal costs are reduced. And I pump it as full of cash as the law and my insurance contract permits. The cash grows tax-free. When I need it for retirement, I'm able to borrow the cash out. And then if I've structured it properly, which we could talk about, when I die at my death, the death benefit will go tax-free, income tax-free, and if properly structured, transfer tax-free to my heirs. And I don't have the politicians deciding on whether I there should be a means test to my withdrawal rights or contribution limits to how much I can put in. I don't have the politicians mandating to me that I provide an equivalent plan for all my employees. I can do just this plan for just me and for nobody else because it's a private contract. So, to me, it is vastly superior in every conceivable way to any other kind of retirement plan. We can talk about that some more, I guess. We probably need to go to break again. We've been yakking long enough here.
We're getting close, Rick. So this is very interesting. And these insurance products, you know, people just have not sometimes focused on them, but they're as you point out, they have phenomenal benefits. And when we come back from break, we need to talk about how to own that life insurance so that because you can own it a bunch of different ways, and some of those ways can get you into trouble. So we'll discuss that when we come back from break, and we'll be back after a minute or two here.
Business community's first choice in Internet Talk Radio, Voice America Business Network.
want to know what's really going on these days? Well, Capital Thinking takes you inside the worlds of policy, politics, law, and business. What happens in Washington, on Wall Street, and in our nation's legal system impacts your business every day. We're taking you on a behind-the-scenes tour of all of it. Each week, we bring you unfiltered conversation with a variety of influential policymakers, lawyers, and business leaders. I'm Kevin O'Neill, and I'm your host as Capital Thinking tours the halls of power. Join me for Capital Thinking on the Voice America Business Network each Thursday at noon Eastern and 9 a.m. Pacific Time.
We hear it and read about it every day in the news.
Stock prices plunging, home prices receding, and unemployment growing.
How can you preserve and increase your wealth in this kind of economy? Tune in to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with host Jay Taylor. Jay will explain the decline of our monetary system and the economy, and will give you winning investment ideas and the tools to protect and increase your wealth. Turning Hard Times into Good Times with Jay Taylor can be heard Tuesdays at 2 p.m. Eastern Time, 11 a.m. Pacific Time on the Voice America Business Channel.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
Tuned in to What About Wealth with Rich Bloomfield and Rick Durfee. If you have a question or comment about our program, please send an email to info@whataboutwealth.com. That's info@whataboutwealth.com. Now back to Rick and Rich.
Okay, Rich, before the break, we were talking about these private contractual alternatives to government-sponsored retirement plans. I want to remind our listeners that as part of this program, we have a special offer that if they contact us, we will send them a free diagram, a large 11 by 17 color diagram that shows all the various structures that we're talking about today and a whole lot more that we just don't have time to talk about. So we invite our listeners to contact us. Now, the question at hand, and I love the question. I get to ask the question, how the heck do we structure the life insurance so that we don't avoid a myriad of problems and disasters that can happen with life insurance? What's the proper way?
Okay, so there's one of two ways. So you either want to own it in the revocable dynasty trust that we talked about earlier, or in an irrevocable dynasty trust. And so why own life insurance in a revocable trust? That we'll start with that one. Because if you've talked to us before or you know anything about this, you know that that still means the insurance is going to be in the taxable estate. And so sometimes that's okay. It just depends on the size of the estate and you know, whether somebody is, what part of their career they're in, but, you know, early in the career, sometimes this makes the most sense. But remember, there are other reasons for putting it into a trust other than just keep it out of the taxable estate. For, first of all, it integrates it into the overall planning, and really, really important, it prevents it from being subject to probate. Now, you know, and I know, Rick, you've probated a lot of life insurance policies because they're typically owned incorrectly. And you'll find that even sometimes when people have a decent plan in place, they still forget and they own the insurance in their personal name. So then it ends up having to go through probate. And it makes it so that after a medical event like a stroke or some other thing, the spouse or other trustee can conduct the business of the life insurance, pay the premiums, borrow cash out, et cetera. And then this is kind of a special use option, and maybe taking care of the spouse is more important than avoiding taxes. So this is suitable, as I said, for the smaller estate or in the early years. But that's one option on how it should be owned. So, Rick, tell us about the second option with the irrevocable dynasty trust.
Yeah, I want to mention, as we pointed out, when you have multiple entities, sometimes we get to pick and choose what's the best place to put this, and often a small retirement plan type of life insurance policy would be left in the revocable trust, and all the rest is going to go in the irrevocable Dynasty Trust, two critical things. The irrevocable Dynasty Trust is outside the taxable estate, which means it goes transfer tax-free to heirs at death, number one. Number two, when it's owned by the irrevocable Dynasty Trust, it's unavailable to everyone's creditors, yours, your spouse's, your children's. None of the creditors can get at the asset, whatever it is, when it's owned by the irrevocable Dynasty Trust, which is an optimum place then for that life insurance, both now and when it pays off and there's some cash. Now, it's important to recognize that there are a few administrative hoops to jump through in the operation of an irrevocable Dynasty Trust, particularly when you're using it to own cash-rich life insurance policies that are going to be used to borrow money against to help fund your retirement years. You typically have to work with a trustee, and some of those little administrative loops that you jump through are just the premium you pay to get the asset protection and the tax treatment that you want. And there are, by the way, this is a whole nother program, there are at least half a dozen ways without violating any laws, without triggering any adverse taxes, without poking holes in the asset protection plan. There are at least half a dozen ways, which we are not going to mention. This is our secret. You have to talk to us in person to find out the answer to this. But there are half a dozen ways to get money out of an irrevocable Dynasty Trust without any problem. And I'm not telling you what it is. It's a secret.
Hey, Rick, one other thing that I wanted to jump back to is that in many states, the other advantage, just on its face advantage, of having this private retirement plan that we're talking about is that life insurance policies in many states are given a special dispensation so that they are creditor-proof just on their face. So even when they're not, you know, inside of an irrevocable Dynasty Trust. So, you know, you probably know more about that than I do, but I know in
yes.
many states that is the case.
That's absolutely true. I also want to mention you triggered another thought. The government hates competition, really, really hates competition. And so they can't prevent people, at least they can't so far, as long as they honor the Constitution, which we can talk about whether that's at risk or not. But they cannot prevent people from entering into private contracts. So these private contractual assets, if you want to call them that, or they can't even call them that technically, but these life insurance policies, they can't stop us from doing that, but they can stop us from calling them certain things. So people who have life insurance licenses are not allowed to call them a retirement plan. They're not even allowed to call them an asset. But me as the lawyer, I don't sell life insurance. I'm not subject to all those licensing things. I can tell you, I as a lawyer, I'm going to call it an asset. I'm going to call it a retirement plan because that's how it functions. That's its functions in the overall planning structure, even though the licensed professionals who actually sell those products probably cannot use those words. Now, there are we're talking about this irrevocable Dynasty Trust, a couple of triggers. How do we know when we need one of those? When is that overkill? When is it necessary? And there's basically three triggers to employ that. One is a large estate. Either have a large estate now or you're going to get one in the future. You're going to develop one in the future because you're a medical professional and you have a big income. And what's large these days? That's a moving target. The politicians manipulate that number. But under the law we have on the books today, unless you're feeling lucky and you feel like you're going to pass away before the year's over, a large estate is anything over $2 million for a married couple or $1 million for a single person. And that's because that's where the estate tax threshold is. So if you have a large estate, more than that, and that includes life insurance, death benefits. Trigger number two is if you have business succession issues. If you have a business and it's growing and you got to figure out what the heck to do with it when you're done with it, then having a Dynasty Trust becomes an important part of the plan. And the third trigger is asset protection. Often, even very small estates, I don't have such a large estate that I would need it for estate tax purposes. But when we're doing asset protection planning, that Dynasty Trust becomes a critical tool for putting things in place. And for medical professionals, even in the early years before they have the big estate, they do have business succession issues and they do have asset protection concerns. And with dynasty planning, with asset protection planning, it's all these multiple entities that we're talking about. It's not just what entities we have, but it's how they're put together, how they're connected, how we integrate that LLC that owns the commercial building with the limited partnership and the two trusts and the professional practice, how we structure the relationships between the entities that actually gives us the protection that we want.
Right. And, you know, the as you kind of work through this whole cycle of life that we all go through in our professions, you know, once the student loans are paid off and that you've gone through having too much debt and foolish investment, overconsumption, you get past those and you really start earning income, you know, what's the safest structure in which to accumulate wealth becomes the question. And and you know, as you've discussed here, it's really not just one entity at that point. It's a number of entities, and we put them together in such a way that that we protect the assets from each other, because sometimes you might want to have rental properties, but should those rental properties be exposed to your practice and vice versa? No, we want to keep them away from each other, and you know, protect the equity in some different entities. So, so we do spend a lot of time, and a lot of professionals, Rick, I know, I've been in on meetings where we've sat down with clients, and they've said, "Look, I'm at the beginning of my career, but I know where I'm going. I know what I'm going to do. Let's set up the whole full blown plan, and I'll just go out and I'll fill up all these boxes because I know where I'm going." And that works really well for many people. You know, one thing you should probably talk to us about with medical professionals, because we haven't focused on it specifically, is how do you protect a home? Because typically, you know, most of the medical professionals I deal with, they've either got a home that's got significant equity or maybe it's completely paid off. How do you take care of that?
I'm glad you asked that, and I want to, as a prelude to answering that question, kind of just put an exclamation point on your comment that sometimes the professionals in their early years know exactly what they're going to do. Having worked with and watched medical professionals over the life cycle of their career many, many times, this is almost staggering to me. Those who in the early years can tell you, "Look, I know where I'm going. I know what I'm going to do. I want to plan for it right now and be prepared, and we're going to make this happen." Those professionals end up far more successful. They accumulate far more wealth. They have stronger, happier families, greater wealth and more enjoyment of them than the ones who you get the deer in headlights look. "Well, I don't know where I'm going. I'm not sure. I got out of school and I guess I'm going to go to work now." The ones that don't know what they're doing don't get very far. So having said that, how the heck do we protect the house? And I kind of want to mention here, really all that we have time for is to mention that in an overall structure, we're going to have a limited partnership. We're going to have a management company, which will be an LLC as the general partner. The two trusts will be limited partners. We're going to have multi-member, member-managed LLCs to own dangerous assets, to keep them away from the good stuff, and to own the valuable assets to insulate them from the bad stuff. And so how do we protect the home? There are a variety of things, and two super critical structures that are very, very powerful. One is what we call the residential occupancy LLC. There's a special way of structuring an LLC specifically to own a personal residence so it retains its tax attributes as a residence, but makes it so that it's unavailable to the creditors. It's a very powerful device in LLC with it, what we call an occupancy agreement. And then we want to put friendly debt on that residence. So we will have one of the business entities loan money, put a mortgage. We will have a home equity line of credit for you to borrow funds either from one of the trusts or from one of the business entities, and we will document that loan with a note, a promise, a revolving credit line promissory note, and we will secure it with a mortgage. We will put a lien against the house in favor of your friendly entity. And it's a 45-minute seminar on why that works and how it protects. But the bottom line is it makes it so that the equity in your home is simply unavailable to your creditors and you're completely protected. I'm right. Concerned that we got to get down to, I want to remind our listeners of our special offer of the free 11x17 colored diagram that details all of these plans together. And I think it's about time.
Yeah, Rick, I think you need to tell everyone, you've been talking about this teaser on, how do you end up with the most at the end here? So, or what is the thing that is the biggest risk to ending up with wealth as a medical professional? So tell us what that is before we run out of time.
Yeah, I can tell you, having worked with hundreds of clients, gone through hundreds of cases where they've been exposed to this risk. And there's one risk event that is the most likely to happen and produces the biggest damage in the accumulation of wealth. You ready for it? Here it is. Divorce. That's it. It's the big D. And early on in my career, another lawyer, in fact, told me, says, Rick, he says, the key to financial success is one wife and one house. he said, yeah, one of each, not two. If you can do one of each, you will be able to accumulate and you will not lose. When you go through a divorce, just take whatever you got. And on your balance sheet and put scratch it off and put zeros there, give it all to the soon to be ex-spouse and start over. And you know, my counsel is marry well and if you're married, stay married. If there's a problem, fix it. If it's really bad and ugly and there's horrible emotional damage, fix it anyway. If you just think it's irreconcilable and we can't make it work and it's done, she won't work with me, he won't work with me, it's over, fix it anyway. Go back and fix the marriage. Stay married. As the lawyer, I cannot overemphasize how horrible it is financially to go through the devastation of a divorce. Now, I recognize in real life there are circumstances where the divorce just has to happen. So I don't want to be insensitive to that. But I also see a great many situations where it's truly an elective. They're opting out because it feels like the cheapest and easiest way to solve some problem, and it's not. It makes the financial problems worse, not better.
Great. Now, we've run out of time, so I appreciate all of you listening, and we will be back here again in another week. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to What About Wealth with hosts Rich Bloomfield and Rick Durfee. Please join us again for another edition next Tuesday morning at 10 a.m. Eastern Time, 7 a.m. Pacific Time on the Voice America Business Channel. Until then, have a profitable week.